Growing up as a Zennial, I had zero interest in the economy. After graduating in journalism, before I knew it, I became a stock market reporter. And that's one of the best things that ever happened to me. In the early noughties, the city of London was a very exciting place to be. Financial markets were thriving. Until it all came crashing down one morning of September 2008, when one of the world's largest banks, Lehman Brothers, collapsed. I'm Charlotte Kahn, I'm an inquisitive Zennial, and in this episode, I thought I'd invite a man I used to interview regularly when working as a business reporter. His name is Gilles Mouek, he's chief economist at AXA Group and AXA IM head of research. Welcome to Zennials. Growing up as a Zennial, I had zero interest in the economy. After graduating in journalism, I landed a job as a stock market reporter. And that's one of the best things that ever happened to me. In the early noughties, the city of London was a very exciting place to be. Financial services were thriving. Until it all came crashing down one morning of September 2008, when one of the world's largest banks, Lehman Brothers, collapsed. I'm Charlotte Kahn, an inquisitive Zennial, and in this episode, I thought I would invite a man I used to interview regularly when working as a business reporter. It's Gilles Mouek, who's AXA Group chief economist and head of research at AXA IM. Welcome to Zennials. Gilles, as an economist, had you ever heard of Zennials? And what do you make of analyzing a generational cohort and trying to understand its traits and characteristics through the lens of economics and fiscal and monetary policies in particular? We know that boomers, for instance, were very much influenced by the post-World War II reconstruction efforts. And as a result, they tend to be described as hardworking, fairly optimistic, and also very career-driven. So tell us, Zennials.
Okay, so I'm a very sad person, so it's not going to surprise you that I didn't know the word actually before you talked to me about it. But yeah, I think generations make sense from an economic perspective. Economists usually love to talk about cycles, right? Cycles of between 5, 10, 15 years. So basically, depending on, you know, when you started working, for instance, during a particular cycle, a very favorable one or a mediocre one, very often is going to have a very lasting impact on your professional life. And you know, there are tons of literature on the fact that, for instance, if you were unlucky enough to start a career during bad economic times, you're going to suffer from it in your job opportunities, in your pay level for 15, 20 years. So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly space for generational analysis in mainstream economics, yeah.
The 1990s are often described as the good decade, an era of strong economic growth. But that's almost a tale of two halves, isn't it? With what's happening in the US and in Europe, they're quite different. And obviously, we are focusing on the West here, not other countries.
Yes, yeah. It's definitely the beginning of the emergence of many areas outside the West. And in the West, I would certainly agree that it's quite different, actually, across the Atlantic. In Europe, the problem we had was that the decade started with unification in Germany. And that triggered a massive shock, actually. Yeah, the Bundesbank at the time was, as usual, super worried about the inflation shock that the unification would create. Hiked interest rates massively, and given the way our European system worked at the time, all the national central banks had to follow suit. And now I was working at Banque de France in the 90s, and basically you could describe monetary policy in France at the time as Bundesbank plus 5 minutes. Basically, you would wait to see what the Bundesbank would do, and then you would follow suit. So we had pretty tough financial conditions. Germany had to work actually quite painfully through the shock of unification. And the ramifications for the rest of Europe were quite grim. So actually the peak in unemployment in a lot of countries on the continent was roughly 94, 95. It's only after 95 that things really started to improve in Europe, at least on the continent. In the UK, it's a different story. In the UK, things went pretty well fairly quickly after the 1992 crash out of the European rate mechanism. But it was same thing. The beginning of the decade was not so great, even in the UK. People may have forgotten about it, but actually 92, 93 was not a good year. In the US, you didn't have that shock from the German unification, obviously. Clinton won the elections on the famous motto, "It's the economy, stupid," because the late 1980s were not great. And then there was the recession triggered, the very short recession triggered by the first Gulf War. But very quickly after 92, things improved very, very nicely in the US. So given the sort of cultural dominance of the US, yes, the general memory of it, maybe, it was a super great year economically. It's not that obvious.
What you've just mentioned is the perfect segue for my next question. You've talked about Clinton. Often we credit the maverick politicians of the 90s with this period of economic growth that maybe happened later on during the decade. But nevertheless, they were the fruit of harsh policies that were implemented in the 80s. And often they are credited with the success of their own policies, but really there's a lot more to it.
Yes, definitely. For me, the best example of that is the UK. The UK went through a very complicated decade of the 1980s. Under Margaret Thatcher, you had this massive supply side reforms, fiscal policy turned to austerity, public spending fell, and your entire segments of the industry just disappeared. Unemployment was actually massive in the UK in the 1980s. And when Tony Blair won the elections in 97, I'm not going to say it was easy, but yes, it was kind of easy because a lot of the dirty job had already been done. He inherited a very low level of public debt, low levels of deficits, low levels of taxation, and he was able actually to make the UK converge to what had become the sort of normal social democratic welfare state that you had in the rest of Europe. It was a catch-up, but he had the financial means of the catch-up, and he could benefit from the surge in what is called potential growth, which was a legacy of the 1980s. So very, very tough period, but giving way to fundamental improvement in the 90s.
Could you describe the 1990s from your perspective as an economist and tell us more about the monetary and economic policy context? I mean, it's often described as an era of great volatility across financial markets. We've got the emerging market crises of 97 and 99 that lasted for quite some time and started in Southeast Asia, of course, and then was followed by Russia and a lot of Latin America. So what about all those crises? I haven't mentioned greater flexibility in exchange rates as well, and a reduction in inflation worldwide.
Yes. Well, inflation was basically killed in the 1980s. That's not a legacy from the 1980s. No, the dirty job had been done. The pain had been inflicted in the 1980s in the form of a surge in employment, so that by the 1990s, inflation was more or less under control. But we still had to deal with a number of shocks, and it felt as if there was the minute you had started dealing with a crisis, there was another one just cropping up. So today it's fashionable to talk about polycrisis, but actually the 90s there was quite a bit of polycrisis as well. It's just they did not feel existential, and in many cases those crises were the product of proper fundamental improvement. If you think about the Asian crisis of the 1990s, to some extent, it was the product of the fact that Asia was actually emerging, was doing well. And as is the case with many countries at the beginning of their economic emergence, well, they don't necessarily have the right monetary plumbing, they don't necessarily have the right banking regulation and so on and so forth. You have to create all this. And very often it takes a crisis to create. It takes a crisis to force, basically, policymakers to deal with those plumbing issues. So, yeah, we had crises, but at the same time, there was a sense that, yeah, we are actually making progress, or it's the reflection of progress. Same thing in Europe. We had those exchange rate crises at the beginning of the 1990s, which I described, with central banks forced to get into super tough monetary policies. But why were we doing it? We were doing it because we wanted to create the single currency in Europe. My view is that it was worth it, right? But I remember at the time, again, I was a super young junior economist at the Banque de France at the time. You had dinner table conversations with your family and stuff, and you were accused of basically, triggering recessions and stuff. And the point we were constantly making at the time was, hey, we have an objective. The objective is to create single currency. It's a cool project. People did not believe in it at the very beginning. It very nearly got killed by the 92 referendum. It was no small feat. It was done. And so there was a sense of, yes, it's complicated. There's a crisis. We need to deal with those moments of volatility. But down the road, it's a good thing. Down the road, we're going to get to something which is much more solid than what we had before.
And Gilles, since you mentioned the growth pains that Asia went through during the 1990s, what about the rise of China during the decade? I mean, China literally started to explode at the end of the 1990s. How did that come about? Remind us.
Well, it was nearly a conscious decision, a collective conscious decision in the West, really. There was this idea that now that the big rivalry with the USSR was over, Cold War was over, quite naturally, we would also converge to what remain, if you want, as the alternative bloc. And China was the other country, the other model. But there was this very optimistic view at the time. Clinton was very much on that view, for instance, that welcoming China in the world economy by gradually creating the conditions that they could, for instance, join the World Trade Organization, we would gradually create a friendlier China. So the development of China was also seen as a way to anchor China into the new, nice, harmonious, and obviously down the road, democratic world order that we thought we would be creating at the time. It was a time of optimism in the sense as well, if you remember, the famous book at the time, The End of History. This idea that the old liberal views from the early 18th century would actually come true. Now, it's actually not Anglo-Saxon, it's French. It's Montesquieu was the first to actually who said that if we engage in free trade, gradually we will come to more harmonious, more civilized international relationships. And this belief was extraordinarily strong in the 1990s. Did not really come to fruition, but
that's for sure. I was going to mention it, actually, Francis Fukuyama and The End of History, and this idea that somehow we had reached the pinnacle of all political and economic systems with neoliberalism. There's one man who really left his mark on monetary and fiscal policies during the 1990s and beyond. Is Alan Greenspan.
Yeah.
Quite a complex and interesting character, isn't he? He helmed the US Fed from 1997 to 2006. What do you make of the man and his policies?
He's a very interesting man, but I guess today we would not choose someone like him to head the Fed. He made his career, he made a fortune actually, by creating a fairly small consultancy at the beginning, which was really good at extracting signals for the markets from the day-to-day data flow. He could translate basically the change in cyclical conditions into signals for the market. So it was a guy who was obviously very well attuned to what was going on in the economy, who knew how to read the economy. But apart from very strong principles, he was a libertarian. It was a disciple of Ayn Rand. Apart from this sort of generic libertarian worldview, he was a guy who was extraordinarily suspicious of big macroeconomic models. So it was a big case of, I can fine-tune the economy by reading what's going on, by reacting to data on industrial productions and employment, etc. I don't need a big theoretical framework. Very different from people like Bernanke or Draghi, who for me were the two latest big giants of monetary policy. People with a very strong grounding in macroeconomic models. Greenspan was, I would call this a fine tuner. But so market loved him. And my reaction at the time, again, I was at the French Central Bank. Maybe we were a bit jealous of the star status of Greenspan at the time. But our view at the time, was certainly my view, was that actually a central banker should not be loved. Actually, it's probably dangerous if the market loves the head of the biggest central bank of the world. And it was the case. He was seen as the complete maverick, the guy who could drive the economy and avoid any sort of accident. And he actually gave way to accidents. And he was probably creating the conditions, first of all, the dot-com bubble of 2001, and probably also played a big role in building up the conditions for the great financial crisis of 08. But at the time, the market was in love with the guy.
Thank you, Gilles. And I promised this audience that one day I will spend more time explaining the principles of libertarianism and Ayn Rand. Let's move on. Europe. A lot happened during the 1990s. You've alluded to it, the adoption of the euro, or the preparation that led up to it. What were the key milestones? And remind us how people felt about it in the 1990s.
It was not obvious, actually, because now it feels as sort of natural state of affairs. But it all hinged on the French referendum in 1992. Which was a near miss. I can't remember the score. It was 51-49, something like this. So actually, clearly, the population was in two minds about monetary union. It was not a walk in the park. It was not obvious to anyone. And then there was also this feeling that we were losing some sovereignty, because we were losing the capacity to decide monetary policy at the national level. And it was not entirely obvious to the public at large what would be the benefit. And it was, in a way, a bit theoretical, because basically what you had to explain to people, it was hard, was, you believe that we have national monetary policies. Actually, it's not true, because we are so integrated that in reality, national central banks at the moment continuously follow the Bundesbank. So actually, we'll be better off deciding collectively rather than just following what the Bundesbank is doing. But it's very hard to convey as a message. And the benefits in terms of, okay, now we have a single market, it's obvious that we need to have a single currency complementing, if you want, this single market. The benefits were not easy to convey. And down the road, what I think it boiled down to get the project across the line, was basically to appeal to sort of generic pro-European feeling, which was still very true at the time. You could still tap into this sort of generic belief that more union is probably good. That did not necessarily hold that well later on, but in the 90s, you could still really tap into that.
Did we reach peak globalization during the late 90s?
Ideologically, yes. Statistically, no. Statistically, no, because peak globalization in terms of the share of imports and exports in global GDP, it's actually not so long ago. It's just before COVID. But in the general mindset of policymakers, yes, it's probably the late 1990s, early noughties. The preparation of China joining WTO, the creation of because in Europe we had the single market, in the US they had NAFTA, so you could see regional free trade zones becoming more and more frequent, and generally speaking, I remember a few guys at the time started saying, that might not be such a great thing. I remember Robert Reich, who was a Labour secretary, I think, under Clinton, writing a book in the late 90s. I remember reading that and thinking, might be something, saying, you know, we are creating a world which is great for what he called symbol manipulators, you know, guys who, people who can work in abstract terms. But for blue collars, it's less obvious. Danny Roderick, the economist, which was the first to start saying, maybe we're going too far. But those were pretty isolated voices. In general, this was this general feeling that, hey, you know, what we're doing is good. And by the way, I still think it's good. I think, you know, I believe in very, very few absolute truth in economics, but that free trade, generally speaking, is a positive. That is one of my beliefs. But it was peak at the time.
And are we going through reverse globalization today?
It's complicated. To some extent, yes. I prefer to call this clubification. So yeah, I want the copyright on that word.
Because, like Xenials.
like Xenials. I call this clubification because it's not as if, you know, regions or countries are retracting on their own resources. It's just that they tend to trade and to finance themselves among friends, if you want, among geopolitical friends. You can see that in North America. In June of this year, it's the first time in 20 years that Mexico sold more manufactured products to the US than China. You can see that also in financial flows. The share of China in holding US debt has been falling for the last 10 years. Europeans, Japanese, South Koreans are actually, you know, raising their share of US debt. So, yeah, we're creating clubs. So it doesn't mean that world trade falls. It's still very much alive. But yeah, it's not just about price and comparative advantage. It's all this plus, am I actually trading with a friend?
To conclude with, what era are we in today in terms of fiscal and monetary policy? And how do you think it will shape today's generation?
Okay, I think on monetary policy, it's a pretty painful normalization. And we've had, thanks to globalization in part, actually, we've had 20 years of extremely low inflation to the point that it kind of disappeared from the collective psyche. I mean, we didn't really have to think about that. And when we had this surge in inflation, when at the end of the pandemic, for a few months, the economic profession believed that it was transitory. I certainly believed it was transitory, and it proved to be much, much persistent. So I don't think monetary policy will ever come back to the sort of zero rate situation we had before COVID. So monetary policy on trend is probably going to be more restrictive. On fiscal policy, we've spent a lot of money over the last few years through the pandemic, also in Europe to deal with the Ukraine crisis. And even in the US, where you could think there was no real reason why they would have to spend that much money, it seems that they want to spend a lot of money. And political polarization, sorry, in the US is so acute that it's very hard to see how they could very easily take control their fiscal policy again. So public debt on trend continues to rise. So for the generation coming now, it might be a bit painful because rates are rising. So if you are at the beginning of, you know, your capital accumulation trajectory, it's going to be more complicated than 20 years ago. And if you count on, you know, government spending to help you along with your studies, with, you know, the beginning of your professional life, insuring you against the big risks, well, governments are going to have a hard time providing you the same kind of support.
I'm tempted to throw in another question, actually, to address the theme I mentioned in my introduction. Did we Xennials somehow benefit more than other generations from globalization, from the start, the emergence of the digital economy? Were we a golden era?
It must. I've I find it hard to answer that because I tend to be a bit allergic to the current generational wars. That's a new theme. You know that the boomers are responsible for everything because they spent far too much money. The zennials are actually very good, and now the new generation is really going to struggle. I have trouble with that because what we constantly fail to see is how much the previous generation had to do and take to get us where we are now. I talked about the 80s. You know, a lot of baby boomers had a hard time during the 1980s, and we forget that. You know, if you were a boomer, but you happened to be working in mining, in coal mining in the UK in the late 70s, my God, you didn't have a great life. So we have to be super careful with that idea. The other thing, and it's, you know, again, I'm a sad person, is that in any case, we didn't know that. I mean, the 90s, yes, in retrospect, it was probably actually a good time to be 20. I was 20 in 1990. It was a good time to be in your 20s, but we did not realize it because, again, the unemployment rate was still very high. Interest rates at the beginning were high. I could not even dream of buying being a house in a flat in Paris at the time. And when I read today, I cannot buy anything in Paris. Well, try to buy a flat in Paris in 1992 when interest rates were 12%. So we have to be super careful with these sort of things.
Thank you very much, Gilles. I think it's time for a Zennials quiz.
Okay.
All right, so Gilles, your favorite album of the 1990s?
Okay, I want to have the right to two because I'm French and there will be one in French and one sung in English. The one in French is Paris Ailleurs, Étienne Dao, 1991. Just looked up before coming at on your streaming device, you can see what you listen from a certain period. So Paris Ailleurs, 1991. If you've never listened to Étienne Dao, please do. Great guy. The English... The one sung in English, because the guy is actually Irish, Neil Hannon, Divine Comedy, Promenade, 1994. A great piece of, the revival of British pop. I mean, it's a great album. Promenade, 1994.
I remember the Divine Comedy. I used to listen to them a lot during the 1990s. And of course, Étienne Dao is from Brittany,
like
you and I. So he would be up there, of course. Your favorite film of the 1990s?
Okay, so the obvious answer would be something that by Tarantino, but I actually don't like his movies. Never liked them, even at the time. So actually, same thing. Sorry, it's going to be French. But if you happen to find this film one day, The Sentinel, La Sentinelle, Arnaud Desplechin, came out in 1992. Super interesting, complex film about basically the end of the Cold War and the ramifications of the Cold War in France. Great, great film. Arnaud Desplechin, The Sentinel.
Thank you very much. Your favorite gadget of the 90s?
I thought about it and remembered all of a sudden. Do you remember the Cyan? Cyan Series 5? It was an organizer with a little keyboard. Obviously, there was no connection, so it could not be a proper tablet. But it looked like the tablet. Came out in 95, 96. I had one for my birthday. You know, you could actually write small text on this small little keyboard. You could run your diary. Don't know what happened. It was a British company and the design was super slick. Cyan Series 5.
I will ask Ben Wood, who was on the previous podcast, to tell us more about this device in another episode. Your favorite book of the 90s?
It's funny because on my way in, I was thinking, a book from the 1990s I really enjoyed. And the first that came to my mind was Less Than Zero by Bret Easton Ellis. And then I realized that it was actually written in 85. But I read it in the 90s, and Less Than Zero feels so 90s, actually, because it's so postmodern. It's really about, bohemian youth lost in a university, engaging in very hedonistic activities. It feels really 1990s.
And finally, one word to describe the decade, the 1990s.
Cool, but we didn't know it.
And you can't say cool anymore, because that's massively uncool,
exactly.
Apparently. Gilles Moëc, thank you so much.
Most welcome.
That was Gilles Mohec, AXA Group Chief Economist and AXA IM Head of Research.